You're listening to The New Paris. I'm your host, Lindsay Tremuda. When it comes to artistic endeavors, Paris shines bright as a historically welcome place to pursue them. The city that gave us the Louvre and some of the finest galleries in the world is full of creative talent, or at least creative inspiration. But how it feels living and working as an artist in Paris is an altogether different story. Today's guest trained as an architect, but has been working as an illustrator and painter for many years, and has a unique viewpoint on the arts. Guillaume Sardin has exhibited his work in Southeast Asia, South Africa, and throughout Europe, created works for French icons like Ruinart and Le Bristol, and talks today about how cultural preservation needs to be a bipartisan ambition. Welcome, Guillaume.
Well, thank you for having me.
Guillaume, I met you through our mutual friend, Frank Barron, and he spoke so highly of you from the moment he discovered your work. I mean, he just was obsessed with the idea of working with you in some way. But what I was surprised to learn was that you weren't initially trained as an illustrator and an artist, but you were an architect. How did that happen? What was that process like of shifting to the arts?
It's quite a, yeah, I was trained as an architect and in Nantes, at the Nantes School of Architecture. And it's kind of a slow process. I got my my degree during the subprime crisis.
Oh, me too. Oh, you know how that screws up your opportunities.
Yeah, it was a tough time. So I applied anywhere in the world, Canada, Australia, Japan, US. And I got a yes from the University of Architecture in Kigali, Rwanda.
That's right. Okay.
So my first shift was going to Rwanda for 4 years. And it was kind of an amazing opportunity of building, you know, a country that was rebuilding itself after the genocide against the Tutsi. And it was an amazing time. And then after, I moved back to France. And it was kind of a challenge to like, start again a career in France.
Did they understand, like, when you were applying for jobs here, did they understand what you had done in Rwanda?
Apart from the people with foreign experience, nobody understood.
Right.
And the two persons that gave me the opportunity, one was a luxury interior designer, and he had some project in Africa. And the other one was another architect, and she did the same thing as me in China. So she understood. And then after, like, I was kind of like bored of architecture because it was what I did in Rwanda was amazing and full of opportunities. And the dialogue with the students, with the builders was so enriching. And then in France, for me, architecture is a beautiful job.
Sure.
But for me, it was like kind of too much on the computer, not enough contact. And also the length of the project were like 10 years or, you know, so a bit too much. And I got the opportunity from Le Bristol because they were looking for an illustrator.
But how did they even know to contact you for illustration? Because that's the part that means that you shifted gears. So when did you decide and how did you shift gears?
I think it started in Rwanda because I started to do more and more design. I was working for the government of Rwanda for some logo types, nothing artistic, mostly like communication design. And then also, like, the funny thing is, like, sometimes I'm quite lazy, so I didn't have any wrapping paper. And I got out of the tradition of, like, draw on paper, my wrapping paper for my friends. And that's how it started.
So, like, craft paper?
No, like any paper. And repetitive pattern of leaves of birds and stuff. And it started like that. And one of my friends that was working at Le Bristol, it was his birthday and I gifted him. And he was like, oh, you know how to draw. I was like, oh, yeah. And they were looking for an illustrator. And that's how it started.
And how long ago was that? The first job as an artist?
I think it was 6 years ago, but I was still also an architect at that
sure.
time. And the full shift was COVID, like so many people.
Oh, the pivotal moment.
Yeah.
Pandemic shifts. But that's, I mean, that's amazing.
No, it's like a bit like Newton, you know, discovering gravity in his garden during the Black Plague. You know, it's
yes, that's one way of looking at it. Yeah. I mean, the pandemic was our plague. So
yeah.
So you sort of said, okay, if I'm going to give this a go. I have to really, you know, develop the habits and the rituals of a working artist.
Yeah. And also, it's also like listening to friends. And I had a friend that was like, if you can't do four things at once, you need to focus on something.
True.
So it was one of the best advice I got. And so the lockdown, I was in Paris in my small apartment, but it was amazing. I had my rituals. I had a small balcony. It was sunny. And then I was drawing the rest of the day. And I got the habit of like pinning my, like a bit of in a jail, but pinning the drawing on the wall to be able to see what I accomplished. I know I still do it in my studio. I still put stuff on the wall like that. And it's really thanks to COVID. And then because of social media and because I had nothing else to do for 3 months, I think, that's how I got like contract after.
And what were you drawing? Like I know what you draw, but the people listening might not know what you tend to gravitate toward in terms of inspirations and figures. And what were you drawing during COVID? And is that the same thing or same focus you have today?
I think so. Like, because the funny thing is, like, before COVID, I didn't know how to draw persons, like
That's
humans.
Wild.
And I think, like, weirdly, like, it's thanks to YouTube.
I mean, this is how people learn. If you have the gift, you just need to like coax it out.
If you have the time.
And the time, you're right. That's true.
But like as a French kid, like I grew up reading a lot of bande dessinée.
Yeah, what do we call them? Not cartoons. We call them...
it's not really comics.
Like comics, yeah, or graphic novels.
Yeah, because comics is a very special style. But so bande dessinée and it all come from Belgium. So the École de Bruxelles.
Really?
Most of them, yeah. Don't tell the French.
I didn't realize that because there's such a big, you know, the festival at Angoulême, yeah. Right, is so huge.
Yeah. The biggest writers, I mean, Asterix is French, but the biggest writers and illustrators are...
Belgian.
Yeah, the style emerged in, from what I understood, emerged from Brussels. It's called the École de Bruxelles.
Wow.
And so I think being fed all of those graphic novels as a child is kind of informed my style of like, it's my drawings are like based on the lines. So this, the outline are very important. And there's the thing you find in Asterix, in Spirou, in the Marsupilami, all those French
interesting.
Gems.
So actually, because for architecture, you do need to know how to... No, you don't need to work with figures?
No, because I was a generation where, I think now it has changed, but I was a generation where like the computer was the apex of creativity. And so out of my 5 years of university, I think I had like 6 months of sketching class.
Okay, so it's really just like you had this gift in you. Really?
Yeah, and I think also it's because my father drew a lot and my great-grandmother. Like, I think I grew up also, and that's the thing, is like, I grew up surrounded by creativity because my mother made all of our clothes.
You're kidding.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. Up until we were 10 or something. And one of her uncle was a cabinet maker.
Wow.
And so, and I slept, my childhood bed is the bed that he made.
No.
It's like a Louis XVI. But I think being surrounded by that and being surrounded by people and objects that were made and not bought.
Yeah.
I think also it's something in the brain because then in the staircase is this like drawing of my great-grandmother and my great-great-grandfather was also like, he was a lawyer, but also he was sketching archaeological studies. So I think it's not me that has a gift. It's because I grew up surrounded by
sure.
the creativity.
But you're also the first to live from this work now, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what is that like? Because you mentioned living in a small apartment, which is where you work.
Yeah.
You live in Paris, which is obviously, I mean, I find it hugely inspirational, but I don't know if, you know, as a living artist, if it actually is too much pressure. I don't, what is that like for you?
Well, the small apartment is because I was an architect. I think it's quite interesting because Paris is, whatever we think of it, is the center of France. Like, it's a very centralized country. And you have more and more artists moving to Marseille or to the south. But there's still this kind of focus on Paris. So I'm not sure it's pressure. I think it's kind of an emulation.
Interesting.
And the same thing, like I used to live in New York for a year when I was 21. And it was the year Obama got elected. So it was like, and that's where like I think it's emulation because you could feel in the street something was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And in Paris, not all the time, but sometimes you feel the same energy. Like not the Obama election, but the emulation because there's so much thing happening. You can talk to other artists and peers. You can learn also from a lot of people like this. It's quite interesting to be in Paris right now.
I feel like also the average French person, but specifically Parisian, has a real respect for the arts in a way that I don't know that every single, I don't know, New Yorker appreciates the value of, you know, creative works and projects that are, you know, maybe abstract or from another time. Do you feel like there's a lot of competition here, or rather that there's just a lot of space for people to create here?
I think it's both.
Okay.
It's both, but it's great because you, without competition, you're not, without doing like Darwinism and economy, but without competition, you don't feel the, you know, the need to venture into new territories.
That's true.
To put it in
you
a
don't
more,
push yourself. You don't.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, when the competition is not, when it's a healthy competition, it's good. And I think it's a healthy competition.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's a space because also there's more and more collectors, and even people our age are collecting art. So when I grew up, like the people around me that were collecting art were like in their 50s or 60s. But I have friends that are starting to collecting art because there's also all the art fairs that are
that's true
in Paris.
And small galleries too, right?
Yes.
This is a city that loves, you know, like house museums and small galleries,
yeah,
and now contemporary event spaces and things like that. How would you define, I saw in the way you talk about your work on your website is that it's like old world meets conversations with like the present or the
yeah,
future. You have a very, unless I'm incorrect in the way I'm interpreting this, you have like a very ancient Greek, Roman flair, like these like gorgeous scenes that feel maybe even mythological. Is that part of your inspiration or your vision for work?
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I think it's a mix of the, thanks to an artist friend, I discovered the old master's drawings. So it's all the painter from, let's say, before the French Revolution, so before the 19th century, and all the sketches. And sometimes it's like more inspiring than the final product to me, because you can feel the energy, you can feel. And one of my favorite time is like the French Renaissance and the Dutch Renaissance, because you have this emulation, you have this desire to venture into new territories, as I said. And so it's a lot informed by that. But then also, when I was at the School of Architecture in Nantes, we had philosophy classes. And Jean Levinck is no longer with us, but he was an amazing teacher. And we were like, we're exploring like the relationship between space and cooking between France and Japan. And he was also a heavy focus on Edouard Glissant, which is, to me, one of the major thinker of the 20th century. He was a French-speaking philosopher from the Antilles,
mm-hmm,
from the Caribbean. And he has this whole concept of creolization, which is this,
yes,
for me, like my architecture thesis was about creolization, and it's still something that in contact with my Rondon student, explore even more. And so with all the respect from the inspiration I have and I study, I think it's a mix of all those influences. It's no longer, it's not just Roman and Greeks. It's like right now I'm working on a ceiling that is a mix of French 18th century painted ceiling, but with also an homage to Pueblo culture from New Mexico. So it's more like this conversation of like being a vessel of colonization in a way with,
That's super fascinating. I think it's also very interesting how much philosophy comes into a field of study that you don't necessarily suspect or realize would be part of the sort of dialogue, the creative and design dialogue. You mentioned Rwanda. You spent a lot of time there. I think you're trying to go back, right, for a stint this year?
I'm normally in a plane in 10 days.
Oh, you are finally. Yeah. Okay. What is it about Rwanda then and now that you find so important to the career you're building?
I think it was kind of like a shock, because as a French, being born in France, and which is totally normal, you don't understand you don't grasp the complexity and the multipolarity of the world. And by landing in Rwanda, I realized that the world, it's maybe stupid, but the world is so vast and so complex, and the complexity is beautiful. And also it's kind of like, I think it de-westernized my point of view, because I was in charge of the curriculum of the history and theory architecture there. And at some point I got like a draft curriculum, and they were like five classes on French and European cathedrals. And I remember when I was a student, like, now I appreciate the cathedrals because I visit them. But if you don't visit them and you just have a list of 10 cathedrals, you don't understand anything, whoever you are, wherever you are. And that's where I realized that the curriculum need to be more focused on the experience of the students, and that what I've been fed as a student might not be relevant now, maybe later when they travel, but now it was not relevant. Mm. And so Rwanda for me, and it's a personal experience and maybe awakening in a way, it was like my Western point of view is interesting, but it's not everything.
I mean, that's important. I mean, we're always in a position of needing to challenge why we think the way we do. And there's like, I think I felt the same when I went to Botswana for the first time. Well, the only time I've been, I'm dying to go back. But, you know, you need to be exposed to something and realize, like, the world does not spin around the U.S. or France or Europe. Like, it feels that way because you're in it. And I'm sure over there, they feel like they're the center of the universe.
Yeah.
So it's just understanding perspectives. So, okay, you're gonna go to Rwanda and you're working on this fresco, ceiling fresco, right? If you're in Paris, though, where do you like to go? I see sometimes on Instagram you post your Sardin Fitness Club, which I think is adorable. You have like, you're usually upside down, I think, hanging upside down. And you've designed like a little logo for your own fitness activity.
Yeah. No, it's kind of like this thing of make everything around you in a way.
Mm.
Like, and also, I mean, the theoretical and the philosophy part of my work is quite serious, but it's not all of that. Sometimes it can be funny, because life is not just like a French philosopher talk on France Culture, which is also super interesting. There was one quite amazing, like, French and American philosopher discussing about the essence of humankind. Super interesting. But life is not just that. So, yeah, thanks to the pedestrianization of the banks, like, I go run a lot. It's nice because being an artist is something that is very focused on you.
Uh-huh.
And then by moving your body, by running and walking out, it's also like helps you also focus on something else.
You become one with the city, right?
You
step out of your little...
Also, it's a dream. Like, all my French friends and Parisian friends are like, why are you running there? And I was like, well, I can see Notre Dame, I can see Le Louvre, then I can have a coffee at Palais Royal, and then when I do my upside down, I see the Grand Palais. It's like, why should I not run here?
Right. Well, where do they want you to run? In a park?
Yeah, like Bois de Vincennes or, you know, the Coulée Verte. But I was like, no, like, that's why, like, I still feel I'm like a child, or, with all respect, an American in Paris in a way, because I have glitters in my eye when
I love it.
Like, this morning I went for a run and then I finished and there was the Grand Palais, the Place de la Concorde. I was like, That's nice.
It is nice.
And we should be grateful for it.
Well, you know, you're very positive and upbeat. Not all Frenchies in the arts, as you said, they're more serious. They're talking on France Culture. They're having big debates about, you know.
France Culture is important.
I know it is. No, I'm just saying that you are someone, and maybe, just maybe, it's because you've traveled a lot. I do find that there's something that is different in a Parisian or a French person who has traveled quite a lot and spent time in other cultures versus, you know, being very franco-français in their everyday life.
Yeah, because
it's a
decenter your... Decenters the way you think, and it does the thing to everybody. I think for you also, like, just by going somewhere else that where you grew up is
That's one step in the right direction of broadening your horizons.
Yeah,
but you mentioned you like the riverbanks, which means you must have some respect for Anne Hidalgo, our mayor.
I mean, as a former architect, and the School of Nantes was also very focused on urban planning.
Uh huh.
It's a complex matter.
It's so diplomatic.
No, but it's a complex matter because it's one of the biggest metropolises in the world, and you need to find the space for everybody. As a user, I'm super happy.
Right.
Because I remember when I moved here, the banks were just closed during the day, and then they reopened at 6 p.m., and I got caught running with cars in front of me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know for cars because I don't drive in Paris. But as a pedestrian, I think it's quite nice also because it reconnects the Parisians to the Seine.
100%.
And I don't think that 20 years ago people were that connected to the Seine before.
No.
So I don't know the full picture because I'm no longer an architect and I'm not a urban planner. But as a user that runs on the banks, I'm like...
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Go for it.
It's great.
Yeah.
And also, this city, as old as it is, wasn't meant for cars. This number of cars, right? Like, come on.
It was not meant for that number of inhabitants also. So.
Right. That's a fair point. Touché, as we say. Okay, that's your brief thought on Hidalgo, which leads me to want to ask you about her nemesis, Rachida Dati, who's our new cultural minister, who was appointed in the beginning of the year. There's a lot of animosity toward her. She's obviously conservative. She's the mayor of the 7th arrondissement. And she worked under Nicolas Sarkozy. So, you know, she's very attached to this bling-bling image that he had throughout his presidency. You and I had lunch somewhat recently, and we talked about this.
Yeah.
And you, I guess, surprised me. And I don't know why it surprised me, because it makes total sense, actually. But, like, you were like, can we wait and see for a second what she does for the arts? Just because a socialist comes in, you know, or someone who's like very left-leaning, it doesn't mean they're going to actually accomplish anything. So why do you think that we shouldn't be so quick to judge her in the role of cultural minister?
Well, because first, we should not be quick to judge anybody.
That's,
I think that's one. It's, I mean, it's normal to have an opinion very fast, but we should not formulate it. I mean, I do, we all do, but we should always try to be aware that we're formulating an opinion based on a feeling and not something else. And I think, like, for example, in France, the Minister of Culture is something that's quite important. And it was created by Malraux and General de Gaulle after the war, a bit after the war. But so it's something that symbolized France. Like, it was created to revigorate the French culture and the way also people have access to culture, and Malraux created the Maison de Jeunesse, the youth houses in everywhere in France, so people can have access. And culture means anything. It can be a museum, it can be dance, it can be performance, it can be a lot of things. And so it started like that, as like, and also state order from the best designer, like Pierre Paulin, that designed a living room. People have to Google that. It's beautiful. Like at the Élysée, like a space age, all white living room that was ordered by Pompidou to the designer Pierre Paulin. And so you have all of that, the complexity of it. And they were people from the right. So the Minister of Culture was created, And also like right, left is like, it's more like how you do it and the devil's in the details. So that's why we need to wait for what she can bring. So far, she recently went on the hip hop radio shows. And I think it's maybe the first time a minister of culture went there.
Right. She also defended Aya Nakamura recently, who has been completely... she's been the victim of all sorts of racist ideology and backlash because she was proposed. There was a rumor that maybe she would open the Olympics with an Edith Piaf performance. And basically the right lost their mind. And Rachida Dati spoke up and was like, let's call this what it is. It's racism.
Yeah. So that means the thing is like, not all the people from the right thought it, but some very vocal person said it. And I think like we have to see what she can bring.
Yeah.
I have no bad or good opinion about her. It's more like, let's wait.
Yeah.
So far, she wants to open the museum to more people because there's still, I think, in France and anywhere in the world, like some people that don't feel they belong in a museum.
Right.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like and in France, even in the region, which is in other cities than France, thanks to the French Revolution, to Napoleon, to the Third Republic, we have amazing collection, like in Rouen, in Nantes, in Dijon. So, but people don't feel they belong there.
Right.
So if a minister can help them feel that they can enter a museum, that's amazing.
And it's already more affordable to go to a museum here if that's if you're paying full price and there are all these discounts and opportunities to have reduced fare. In the US it is like all private nearly.
Yeah.
And it's astoundingly expensive. When I was in New York a couple months ago, went to this Austrian gallery and it was like $28 per person, before tax and all that stuff. And that does add up. The Musée d'Orsay here is 16 euros.
That's still a lot for French people.
For French people, but like that was full price.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other people. There were tons of senior citizens who didn't pay that and students who definitely don't pay that.
But imagine you're a family of four, the children doesn't pay, but you still have to pay 32 euros.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. The cost of living.
It's still expensive.
Right. So if she can do that, that would be incredible. And I was speaking to a gallerist who's very leftist here, who also was very happy to like pose for a photo with Rachida Dati at some cultural thing when she was appointed.
Yeah.
And I was surprised, again, my error, but she was like, look, if she can bring money into the arts, that's more than what the previous woman did.
Well, the other didn't have much time.
No,
also.
She was also like a blip in the
Because she had a very government. She had a very also interesting point of view.
But she's also, I think you and I talked about this. The previous minister was from the art world, right?
Yeah.
And Rachida is not.
Yeah.
And so maybe that actually is a good perspective to have.
I think we shall see.
Right.
We shall see in a few months. But I think it's quite exciting. It's quite exciting to have someone like Rachida Dati trying a new methodology, because none of the previous failed. They were all good ministers. They had a different approach, and none of them were bad ministers. They all had a different angle. But with Rachida Dati, it's a new methodology. So let's see. Like maybe it's gonna work.
I like your thinking. Very positive. You sure you're not American?
So far, I don't know. I'm not sure.
So speaking of American, obviously I have a lot of American listeners. They're not all American, but many of them. And I know that they love to know where, my guests go for, to find inspiration, where they like to go when they need time by themselves.
Yeah.
You talked about running along the Seine. Are there, I know not, like nothing is hidden anymore, but is there anything that's a bit more under the radar that you like as a creative source?
That's a good question. There's a lot of, it depends of, for Paris, if you go anywhere before 11, it's empty. So that's a good thing.
11 a.m.
Yeah,
right.
11 a.m. Wake up early and be there before the Parisians, because Parisians generally before 11 a.m. or noon, they're not really there yet. And then there's like a lot of things outside of Paris. I don't know if they say, if you said in American, the Stendhal syndrome.
No, it's like, I don't think so.
The Stendhal syndrome is like where you, so Stendhal apparently went to a church in Florence, and that's because there was so much beauty, he fainted.
Ah.
So it's a bit like the Zazatsu from Sex and the City in a way. And so there's some places where you can have that, like you're not going to faint, but there's some amazing places like half an hour outside of Paris. And the one I went to just after COVID was the Chateau des Coins, which is the Renaissance Museum.
Oh.
It's a beautiful Renaissance castle with amazing collection, fresco from the Renaissance. And you walk through a forest to access it. There's a lot of like places like that.
Yeah.
In outside of Paris, like you have the Chateau de Maison,
yeah,
which is also near the Corbusier Villa, Villa Savoie.
And the Rose Bonheur house in Seine-et-Marne.
Yeah. So all those little things, if you're visiting Paris and you have a bit more time, it's the same thing in New York, go to Diabacon. Well, in Paris, you can go to Malmaison, the Josephine house.
Yeah.
But I think Écouen is, because I love the Renaissance, Écouen is like a dreamy place.
I'm going to put that in the show notes so everyone knows how to spell it and find it. And are there certain artists that you find particularly compelling that you've discovered, older artists that you can discover through some of these adventures?
Yeah, like there's, you have like, because of the Renaissance, you have Rosso Fiorentino and Le Primatis, which are beauty, like crazy artists, Italian artists that got hired by François Ier, the King of France of the time. And then you have all the 18th century, Lebrun, you can find like Stealing at Le Louvre, I think, or at Versailles, all the mirror halls of Versailles, the ceiling is painted by him. There's a lot. And that's why, like, if you go to the Louvre, like, go to the rooms where there's nobody.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's also, I think one time I went on a tour of the Dutch wing and it was much calmer. And it's so gorgeous.
The Dutch Renaissance.
Yeah, it was phenomenal.
It's like,
But before we started recording, you mentioned someone, a female artist.
Yeah.
From the 1930s, you said?
Yeah. So I recently, it was on my bucket list. It's kind of a controversial building because it used to be the Ministry of the French Colonies.
Ah.
And it's near Port Doré, so it's within France, near Bois de Vincennes. Within Paris. Paris is France. No, I'm joking. So it's near the Bois de Vincennes on line one. And now, thanks to François Hollande, it's a museum of immigration.
Right.
With amazing recontextualization of all the immigration wave, I think starting from the 17th century and up to now, from Europe, from Africa, from other countries and region. So beautiful recontextualization of the migration path of France. But the building was built for the Exposition Coloniale, which is a highly problematic and questionable exhibition that was held in Paris. But the building was designed by the best artists from the Art Deco period. And it's one of the few buildings we have like that in France, because just after that, it's World War II.
Right.
And so the facade is like a bas-relief glorification of the French colonization. So the subject is problematic, but the execution is one of the best Art Deco
structures.
Yeah. And inside you have two offices with frescoes, and one has like furniture by Ruhlmann, which is a French furniture maker from that time. And one is painted by a couple, which is André and Ivana Lemaître, and they work together. And you have pictures, you can find pictures online of them painting the office, and they were very famous for their fresco at that time.
Hmm.
And it's this beautiful mix of like the fresco from the Renaissance with the Art Deco. And the topics are about the French colonies, but the execution and the story between this couple, those two people working together, is quite amazing.
Well, I think like what you said, it's recontextualizing what happened. And so I'm glad we have a space where there's a way for people not to run away from this past, but to better understand it. Because I know that in some parts of the country, in like far right territory, they don't want it to be taught to the way that it needs to be remembered?
I think that the debate may be less divided than in the US.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we're not quite where,
yeah,
you know, they want to pretend like, you know, there has never been any violence against any other people. And
But the Museum of Immigration is quite a nice statement of accepting, not forgetting. And also it's like about all the waves of migration. And there's also like beautiful posters from all the 80s about the anti-racism war,
That's right.
And Touche pas à mon pote, which was a big movement in the 80s when I was young. So the building is amazing Art Deco with a dark past, but beautiful Art Deco with fresco by Ivana and André. It's crazy. And then the museums that were opened like 10 years ago, I think. Quite interesting to understand how France has evolved.
Well, and Paris just has a massive wealth of museums and cultural spaces where you can discover something like that and then go back even further in time. And, you know, like you could spend your entire year going to different, you know, to discover some of this stuff. So you're right. Paris is really full of this. Where can people find and maybe buy some of your work? Because that's the next big step for you, right? Is to try to, we want a little piece of you, Guillaume.
Yeah, no, that's in the work. So I'm going to open a because I mostly do private commissions right now for so big ceilings, and also I painted some a powder room for people, which was kind of a fun project. So I do a lot of large private commissions, and so now I'm doing more and more paintings, smaller paintings, and also working on collectible object.
Oh, I love it.
But still with the same, I think, wit between, you know, the mixing the past with the present and not being bowing to the past, but, you know.
Yeah, like
playing
considering
with it.
Playing
with it with a lot of respect and love. So I'm going to open a shop soon online where you can buy like original drawings or objects. And one of the first one will be a deck of cards.
Love it.
So it's a deck of cards on love triangles from the Roman Empire. And it's based on, I don't know if you say in American, Suetonius, which was a writer from the Roman time, who wrote like such a weird book about the past emperors and the decadence of them. So it's going to be a witty note to Suetonius' book with like love and hate triangles, like a grandmother killing her son. And then, because there's like there's one of them, I think it's a diamond figures. It's Heliogabalus, which was like one of the last emperor. And he was put on the throne by his grandmother. And according to what we know of him, he had two wives and two husbands. And one of the husbands was a Greek chariot driver. So, and then her grandmother killed him because she had enough of him. So it's going to be a fun deck of cards.
I like it.
Love triangles, because you also have Cleopatra and Mark Antonius and Julius Caesar.
Sure.
It's not just murders. It's also a lot of love.
Good. Full of human interest stories.
Yeah.
Plus amorous.
It's a conversation starter.
I love that. Is the perfect way of framing it. I love it. Well, I cannot wait to get my hands on that. And everyone can follow you for now on Instagram, where you'll announce this shop,
yes.
I'm assuming. So what is your handle? It's
in French is Gsardin. In English is Gsardin. So basically sardine without the E.
Cute. Guillaume, thank you for coming on the show. I love your work, and I can't wait to see where you go next and get that deck of cards and continue to talk to you about the arts.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the New Paris Podcast. If you enjoy the show, it would mean the world if you would rate and leave a review on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, à bientôt.